The following podcast contains dramatizations of actual events. Certain situations, dialogue, names, and locations may have been changed. Some scenes are graphic in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
Up next, the way this fire burned has even experts wondering what happened.
Fire did not behave in a manner that appeared to be typical.
A body is found, but something about it confounds investigators.
The position of his body, to me, seemed a little unusual from what I'd experienced in other fatalities.
It raised questions of, well, was he already deceased from some reason? Was there some kind of a medical situation?
If it's murder, how was the victim killed? And if this is murder, can detectives prove it? Every fall in Morgantown, West Virginia, home of West Virginia University, football reigns supreme. On Monday, November 28, 2005, the city was still reveling in a recent victory over the University of Pittsburgh in the so-called Backyard Brawl, one of the oldest rivalries in college sports. But celebrations by local firefighters didn't last long. That morning, they were called to a fire in a suburban neighborhood.
We heard on the radio that there was a structure fire on Killarney Drive, which was in the north section of the city, in the city of Morgantown.
Firefighters were met at the scene by a man named Bobby Teets. He identified himself as a friend of the family that owned the home.
Bobby Teets was at the scene. I remember him saying, if his car is in the garage, he's there. And of course, I had no idea what he was talking about. At that point, we didn't know that there was potentially somebody, victim in the house.
The person he was referring to was Jimmy Michael, the homeowner. Jimmy's wife, Michelle, a local nurse practitioner who worked at a hospital a few miles away, arrived at the fire shortly after Bobby Teets.
Firefighting efforts were still being made. She was actually there while it was on fire.
The Michaels' children were at school, but as everyone feared, once the fire was out, a body was found inside the house.
It was a body that was very badly burned, very little left of internal organs and that sort of thing.
At the scene, it was impossible to make a definitive identification. Meanwhile, fire investigators immediately noticed odd things about this fire.
Walking through the first floor, a lot of the areas you'd have never known a fire had occurred in the house. And that struck me as kind of unusual. I knew that, we're going to be dealing with something kind of strange here.
This particular fire, at least in its final stages, burned very hot, achieving what arson investigators call flashover, demonstrated in this training video.
Flashover is when a fire in a room becomes a room on fire. When everything that isn't already burning in the room ignites essentially simultaneously.
A fire that reaches flashover generally creates a lot of damage. But that's not what happened here.
Fire personnel noticed that it was really one room of the house that was on fire.
That room was the master bedroom where the body was found. It looked as if the victim made no effort to escape the fire.
What they were struck with was that it looked like he'd just gone to sleep and he hadn't made any effort in a fire to try and escape or anything. He was in a sleeping position.
Dental records confirmed the victim was 33-year-old Jimmy Michael, the father of two and stepfather of two more. Since the position of his body indicated he may have died before the fire started, the possibility of murder loomed large.
In this case, it was enough to say we have a huge red flag. We had several red flags.
Jimmy Michael and his wife, Shelley, had each been married before they found each other, divorced their respective spouses, and joined their families together.
She had two children from a prior marriage. Jimmy Michael had been married before, had two children from a prior marriage. They had a very normal life, just a normal, everyday, middle-class family here in Morgantown.
While Jimmy's body was sent to be autopsied, fire investigators set about determining what started the fire that may or may not have caused his death.
There were no positive laboratory results for an accelerant, a liquid accelerant or anything like that. There were no electrical artifacts inside the structure that showed that the fire was an electrical fire.
The fire had burned a hole in the bedroom floor, which opened up to the living room below. A clothes iron found in the bedroom was initially turned to as a possible fire starter.
The iron had to be considered as a potential ignition source because it was found in a position that indicated it would have been in contact with combustible materials.
But even though the iron had been turned on, it was not what started the fire.
A modern iron's a pretty safe device. The base plate that heats up will only get to about 400 degrees. Paper ignites 451 degrees. So, you know, 400 degrees, it won't even ignite paper.
Since Jimmy obviously made no attempt to escape the fire, was it possible he'd taken his own life and wanted to hide his suicide by torching the house with a clothes iron? Or was he killed by someone who then set the fire? With his body so damaged, his autopsy provided limited but vital information.
The very interesting thing about the autopsy was that Mr. Michael's lungs and air passages were free from soot and any evidence of having inhaled smoke. And so it was apparent from that to the medical examiner that the fire had not been the cause of his death.
This answered the question of why Jimmy hadn't tried to escape the fire. But the question of how he died was still open, and investigators worried he'd sustained so much damage it would never be answered. But just enough remained for a toxicology test.
It was a deep, deep muscle tissue samples is what we sent to the lab.
As is normal in any potential murder, investigators first looked at Jimmy's wife, Michelle, known as Shelley. The 33-year-old was an attractive, successful, and well-respected nurse practitioner. The couple had been married for 5 years.
Shelley Michael went to the University of West Virginia in Morgantown, in fact, to study nursing. She got on the cheerleading team. Shelley was Jimmy's perfect woman. Some of his friends told me that his dream girl was a cheerleader.
By all accounts, it was a happy marriage, and Shelley had an alibi for the time of the fire. She was seen at work at the local hospital. So now detectives turned to Bobby Teets, who, in what might or might not have been a coincidence, was at the fire scene even before firefighters. He was a longtime friend of both Shelley and Jimmy Michael. In fact, Bobby worked for Jimmy's business, providing respiratory equipment to local hospitals.
They were family friends. They were kind of best friends. They did everything together. They were constantly at each other's houses.
But as detectives continued talking to Bobby Teets, they found there was a lot more to his friendship with the Michael family than originally thought.
Well, before the fire, I don't think anyone would have described it as anything other than a friendship and a business relationship. It wasn't until after the fire and the death of Jimmy that things began to unravel.
Who would have had a reason to start that fire?
I wanted Jimmy here.
Who would have a reason to start it?
Nobody that I know.
As detectives looked to see if Bobby Teets, Jimmy Michael's longtime friend and employee, had any reason to harm him, they got an unexpected phone call about Teets and Jimmy's wife, Shelley. Soon, detectives, acting on this tip, came upon this image, shot with a security camera at a Chicago hotel. In it, they saw Shelley Michael and Bobby Teets checking into the same room.
It became apparent through information that was gathered by investigators that they had something more than a business relationship. He first denied that he had any kind of a personal or romantic relationship with Michelle.
When confronted with this image, Bobby Teets could no longer deny the affair.
Jimmy tried, but that was the hardest thing.
When was the first time?
That was it. First time.
When was the other time?
But Bobby Teets adamantly denied having anything to do with Jimmy Michael's death, and he had what might or might not be a plausible explanation for why he got to the fire even before firefighters.
Jimmy delivers respiratory equipment, and Bobby Teets worked for him, and he became alarmed, you know, that Jimmy hadn't turned up. So when he heard about a fire, he went there and said, well, if Jimmy's car is in the garage, then he's probably in the house.
Bobby's affair with Michelle Michael was a clear motive for him and for her. Now detectives asked Michelle the same series of questions they'd asked Bobby Teets.
Those people on that, is there any kind of affair going on with Bobby?
Nothing like that.
This is the biggest question I have right now. The relationship with you guys is a little suspect right now.
Yeah, I promise you, friend.
Then Michelle, just like Bobby Teets, was confronted with the evidence.
She did admit to the affair after probably 50 or 60 times on tape saying, no, I never did that. I've never done this. I've never done that.
And I want you to do a little soul search. And I want you to help me solve this crime.
The question now was establishing where Michelle Michael was on the morning of the fire. She said it was a typical Monday morning.
Did you see Jimmy before you
left? I gave him a kiss before.
Okay. Anything weird about that? Okay. And you're at the hospital by what time?
I think I was there by 6:10 or 6:15.
After getting to work, Michelle said she never left the hospital. But security video, once again, contradicted her story.
There are cameras really in every inch outside that building and inside that building and in the parking lots. Officers then began to confirm her comings and goings on that date.
This showed Michelle leaving the hospital at 8:11 a.m. and returning at 8:28. A total of 17 minutes, and her house was only 5 minutes from the hospital.
And then her story changed. It was an ever-changing story that she represented to law enforcement.
And now that it became known that Michelle was a possible suspect, detectives got another tip from a volunteer fireman about the morning of the fire.
This is when you kind of get that good luck sometimes as a police officer. He was going to the volunteer fire station. And he just happened to take a shortcut that put him directly in front of Shelley Michael's house. And he said, I saw Shelley in her big SUV back out of the driveway and then speed off.
This sighting took place during the 17-minute window in which Shelley had left her job at the hospital. But this only proved that Shelley was lying about her whereabouts on the morning Jimmy died. It didn't look good, but didn't prove conclusively that she lit the fire. To get that proof, arson investigators set their own fires, a series of what are called test burns, in an attempt to find out what really happened.
The best way to find out was to do full-scale testing, furnish it with comparable furnishings and comparable carpet, comparable construction, and burn it to see what happens.
Investigators analyzing the fire that almost consumed Jimmy Michael's body had certain facts that were not in dispute. They knew Jimmy's wife, Michelle, lied about where she was on the morning of the fire, a fact confirmed by a witness who saw her at her house around 8:30. This was also confirmed by surveillance video at the hospital where Michelle worked. She was gone for 17 minutes.
17 minutes was more than enough time to drive to her residence, go into the residence, either set or make sure the fire was burning,
Fire investigators theorized that the fire started during the time Shelley left the hospital between 8:11 and 8:28 a.m. And they knew when the fire reached flashover, because by that time, about 10:30, they were at the scene. But even veteran arson investigators had to admit that 2 hours was an awfully long time for an arson fire to burn.
This fire started around 8:15, 8:30, but nobody found it until 10:27 a.m. Does this make any sense?
The thing is, fires do make sense. They burn in predictable patterns. With the timeline in hand, and knowing all the materials in the master bedroom and its measurements, analysts decided to recreate the fire.
So we did rebuild the bedroom. It makes us better witnesses in terms of understanding the science of what might have happened. So we had a pretty good understanding of the materials that were in the space.
A critical factor in this fire recreation was replicating the HVAC system, the heating and cooling mechanism in the Michael House. The HVAC would affect how much oxygen got in the room. Also key was the fact that the door to the bedroom was closed during the fire.
The fact that the door was closed closed the fire off from available air in the rest of the house and provided a severely ventilation-limited condition for the fire to evolve.
Analysts focused mainly on three of their test burns. In the first, the HVAC system was not on. Predictably, this cut the oxygen levels and the fire burned out fairly quickly. In the second test burn, the HVAC system was on full. This made for plenty of oxygen, and this fire created a hole in the floor in well under 2 hours. In the third test, the HVAC system was cycling, meaning it was on automatic, and turned itself off and on. This is where the Michael's HVAC was set on the morning of the fire. In this test, because the oxygen levels were fluctuating, the fire would almost go out and then come back to life. It took over 2 hours for this fire to burn through the floor, which is exactly what happened in the actual fire.
The main variable here was changing the HVAC, or the flow of air into the compartment, which is so important to combustion. We had cameras in our structure in the floor joists. And at 2 hours and 12 minutes after ignition, we had flaming debris fall onto our burn room below.
This proved arson, and Shelley Michael was the only person seen at the house before the fire started. Bobby Teets, her lover, and Jimmy Michael's business partner had a rock-solid alibi for the very same time period. He was never charged in this case. The final question, how was Jimmy Michael killed, was answered once the toxicology results came in. He had a drug called rocuronium in his system.
Rocuronium is what's known as a paralytic, and it basically paralyzes your body.
Michelle Michael would be able to get access to the rocuronium, and she was charged with first-degree murder and first-degree arson.
The evidence left no doubt. Even though Shelley appeared to be a typical suburban housewife and had never committed a crime, this was cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Her lawyer described her looking in her eyes as like looking in Charles Manson's eyes. That woman's scary.
One of the themes that we used during trial was love and money. You know, those are two motives often that we have separately or together in a murder trial. And in this case, we suggested that it might have been both.
The $500,000 insurance policy was definitely a motivation for the crime. And I think that also maybe it would have been the affair with Bobby Teets. That might have been motivation.
In 2007... Michelle Michael was found guilty of first-degree murder and arson and was sentenced to life in prison. After her conviction, she addressed Jimmy's family in court.
Hey, Jimmy's life. I swear to you. I don't know what happened. I wish I did. If you want to believe I did it, and it helps you heal, and it helps you have closure, then please blame me, because I don't want you in pain anymore.
Prosecutors told jurors a horrifying story. They believe Michelle injected her husband with rocuronium as he lay sleeping, paralyzing him almost instantly. Then she made her first mistake. She thought the iron would start the fire. It didn't. She went to work expecting to get a call that her house was on fire. When that didn't happen, she made her next mistake. She left work, apparently not realizing there were surveillance cameras. Minutes later, the volunteer fireman saw her at her house. Once inside, she made sure the bedroom was on fire, and then she committed her final mistake. The one that ultimately preserved the evidence that landed her in jail. She closed the bedroom door.
Nurses are actually trained that if you have a dead patient in the room, to close the door so that you don't upset the other patients.
With the door being closed, it consumed the available oxygen in the room and it became ventilation limited.
Had she not closed that bedroom door on the way out, the house probably would have burned to the ground, and the body would probably have been too badly damaged for us to be able to determine that he would have been injected with rock uranium.
I guess she thought she was capable of committing the perfect crime. She should have left the door open in the bedroom. That might have helped her.